able to survive under extreme conditions on Earth, it raises the hope that the same might be the case in other worlds. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from Eve Brunn in biology. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41. On the Afternoon Magazine, in sports this afternoon, Illinois opens the Big Ten schedule tomorrow against defending champion Ohio State. The Illini have won 3 of their last 4 and 7 of the last 10 they've played in Columbus, including a 28-21 shocker in 2007. Ohio State teams have won or shared the last 4 Big Ten titles, meanwhile. The St. Louis Cardinals will clinch a division title tonight with a win against the team they might face in the National League playoffs. Chris Carpenter gets the start tonight against the Colorado Rockies, who lead the National League wildcard race by 3.5 games. Meanwhile, the Chicago Cubs continue their series against San Francisco tonight. They send Carlos Zambrano to the mound against Giants ace Tim Lincecum. A Cubs loss tonight would give St. Louis the National League Central crown, even if the Cardinals lose. The White Sox try to avoid officially being eliminated from the postseason tonight as they host Detroit. A loss in any of the 3 weekend games with the Tigers ends any playoff chance for the Sox. Chicago Bulls star Derrick Rose is facing fresh questions about the SAT test he says he took before going to Memphis. The NBA's Rookie of the Year last season, Rose found himself at the center of a scandal over the summer when the NCAA ruled that Memphis must vacate its 38 wins and national championship game appearance during the 07-08 season. The NCAA said the school used an ineligible player that is believed to be Rose. Rose was at Bulls Media Day today and said he took the test, dismissing any suggestions that someone else took it for him. New Jersey Nets owner Bruce Ratner says the sale of that NBA team to Russian businessman Mikhail Prokhorov is the final piece to building an $800 million arena and moving the Nets to Brooklyn. Ratner says in a phone interview today with the Associated Press that the joint Russian-American venture still requires that he sell almost $600 million in tax-exempt bonds by December 31st, but he sees no problem in getting that done. Ratner says ground will be broken on the new Barclays Center in Brooklyn by the end of the year. The Indiana Pacers assigned coach Jim O'Brien through the 2010-2011 season. O'Brien initially signed a 3-year deal in 2007 with an option on a 4th. The team did not disclose terms in today's announcement. Pacers president Larry Bird says he feels the team is moving in the right direction. The Pacers have missed the playoffs in the first 2 years of O'Brien's tenure with identical 36-46 records. An Indiana Fever forward, Tamika Catchings, has been named the WNBA's Defensive Player of the Year for the 3rd time. Catchings won in a landslide with 34 votes. Her 99 steals this season were one shy of the WNBA's single-season record of 100 set by New York's Teresa Weatherspoon back in 1998. And that's a look at sports.
The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana. Today's programs are made possible with support from Parkland College Theater, presenting Lend Me a Tenor from Wednesday, September 30th through Saturday, October 11th. More information is available at 351-2528.
It's the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, 16 minutes before 3 o'clock. I'm Tom Rogers. We often take the buildings around us for granted. That is, until those factories, schools, or big retailers close shop. Then the people of the community are left wondering, what's going to happen to that building? One photographer is making a career out of documenting the surprising ways that people deal with this. The Environment Report's Sean Ali met her in the heart of America's Rust Belt.
I meet Julia Christensen in Gary, Indiana. She's here for an art project. Christensen's going to photograph buildings in Gary and ask people how they could be reused in the future. I'm supposed to be the chauffeur.
Well, so we're going to Fifth Avenue.
And where is that exactly?
Right.
Well, I'll get to her current project in a sec, but with all these wrong turns, I've got a chance to ask about her artwork in general. I mean, what's the point of documenting how people reuse buildings?
Urban space is a structure that we all share. No matter how you look at it and interpret it, there it is, you know, on the ground in front of you.
Christensen's got plenty of examples. She's done photo exhibits of buildings in several cities, and she wrote this book called Big Box Reuse. It's about how people reused buildings abandoned by Walmart, Kmart, and other big retailers. She photographed one big box store that got turned into an indoor go-kart track. Another became a school. And one store turned into a museum dedicated to a canned meat, Spam.
What it did was create this sort of like niche tourist industry. You know, over 10,000 people a year come to the Spam Museum and they spend money in the town, and it actually has done something towards revitalization of this city.
Christensen says the point is that when big box stores get abandoned, they can become a blight, kind of like one building ghost towns with enormous parking lots. She found that people assumed they were the only ones facing this problem.
They'd be like, huh, you mean there's other ones? Other people have done this? How did they deal with those glass panes on the front? And how did they deal with those central pillars? And, you know, I became this, like, traveling storytelling person who had information about big box reuse.
Christensen says she's got a new art project now. She's interviewing people about old industrial sites, commercial buildings, and homes. Then she'll write stories about how these buildings could have totally new uses 30 years from now. Then she'll put photos and text together for art exhibits or maybe a book.
Like an exercise to take these photographs and write a caption for them in the context of the next 30 years. So it's a little bit more exploratory.
Right now, Christensen is touring Rust Belt cities that are dealing with abandoned buildings. Gary, Indiana is just one stop.
So we'll turn left at Broadway.
Christensen got a tip about a closed building.
It is a closed performing arts school. It closed a few years ago when the city had to consolidate the schools.
Christensen and I meet a young man named John. He lives nearby, and he tells Christensen that the closed school is kind of an open wound.
You have a lot of kids running through there, trust me. You see how the window's broken in?
But Christensen asks John, what about the future? What could this building be?
But I always thought about this being a recreational center or something like that. People can play indoors, basketball stuff all year round, stuff like that.
Christensen notes all this and takes some snapshots of the school. She'll do this again and again in Gary and other Rust Belt towns. Christensen says she wants to return someday, maybe with a book or a photo exhibit. That way people can start talking about what could happen to these places.
People can come to the arts and access a photograph or a sculpture or a creative website from across the board. So I see the arts as central in the conversation about what our future is going to look like on the ground.
Christensen says documentaries or art cannot solve all the problems people face with abandoned buildings, but maybe they could be a good place to start. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
From yesterday's buildings to tomorrow's tweets, the social networking service Twitter has a lot of social credit, but not necessarily a lot of money. We're talking here, of course, about the internet service that allows for short 140-character messages, or tweets as they're called. And despite being extraordinarily famous now, the company is not making any money. That's not deterred investors, though. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports on just how enthusiastic those investors are about Twitter.
A group of investors is reportedly about to give Twitter as much as $100 million in new funding. But what has people talking is that the deal values Twitter at $1 billion. Investors are betting that the internet's fastest-growing social networking site will turn into a financial powerhouse. Analyst Rob Enderle isn't convinced and says the investment reminds him of the craziness of the dot-com era.
Imprudent would be putting it lightly. There is no proof that they can ever reach profitability in line with a $1 billion valuation.
Analyst Mark Mahaney of Citigroup is also skeptical. He notes that while Facebook has finally turned a profit, there's no way to know if Twitter can match that.
If people decide they no longer want to use Twitter and they want to use something else, then Twitter can be an overnight sensation that's gone when the morning comes.
So far, Twitter has had no comment on any of this, not even a tweet. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
The most radical change in the fall TV season is Jay Leno's move to prime time. by putting his comedy talk show on at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central, 5 nights a week. NBC took a huge gamble. Conventional wisdom says dramas are the most popular shows in that time slot. 2 weeks and NPR's Elizabeth Blair checks in on Leno.
It's pretty much late night, Jay Leno, only earlier and without the desk.
And Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi ducked. This moron was at the UN today. You see him? He talked forever. He talked on Israel and the swine flu and the JFK assassinations. Where was Kanye West to grab the microphone away?
The new Jay Leno show has not been a ratings bonanza. It started off with a bang, reaching more than 18 million viewers that first night. But 1 week later, that number plummeted, putting NBC in third place in the 10 p.m. time slot. Since Jay Leno is relatively cheap to produce, NBC will still make money.
They set the bar low to begin with, and it's about to go lower, I think.
Ken Tucker is editor of Entertainment Weekly. He says Leno really has his eye on the 18 to 49-year-old set.
If he can't keep up a certain age group, advertisers are going to flee from that.
Once upon a time when Jay Leno was in a fierce ratings battle with David Letterman, he stepped up his game, made changes, and eventually won. NBC executives say they'll judge the Jay Leno show after it's been on for 52 weeks. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Sunday marks the start of the 42nd season for the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes. It remains an exception for commercial TV news, a top-rated show that often takes on serious topics. NPR's David Folkenflik looks at the secret of that success.
60 Minutes usually prepares its stories months in advance, but that means preparing for the unknowable.
The CDC is sending go teams to a couple of these spots, especially.
Senior producer Michael Radutsky was recently making the case that 60 Minutes should have two teams of journalists poised to fan out across the globe to cover the spread of the swine flu. It would be expensive, and these days in network news divisions, every dollar counts, but executive producer Jeff Fager is on board.
The CDC's jumping on American hotspots like that.
Right.
We're going to
wait till
with them to South America now.
I think we should probably go to South America now.
You hear it said a lot these days that broadcast TV news is a dinosaur, soon to be extinct. Maybe so, but then 60 Minutes is a T-Rex, thundering around the landscape. Nielsen Media Research says it was the 10th highest rated TV show last season. Here's Jeff Fager.
We had an enormous responsibility to fulfill our commitment to be there when important stories break, and to report them in a way that I think we do uniquely, which is to dig down deeper and help people understand them.
The show drew an estimated 14 million viewers each Sunday night. That's 2 million more than the year before.
I think the news just took over.
That's longtime correspondent Steve Croft.
How are you not going to do stories about a financial collapse? How are you not going to do a story about the first black presidential candidate and the most closely watched presidential campaign since 1960, probably? You have to do them. That's what everybody is interested in.
Along with Leslie Stahl, Croft used to make up the youth movement. Now he's in his 60s. Mike Wallace has finally retired. Ed Bradley died. Morley Safer works part-time. And Croft swears he won't hang on forever.
There used to be a very clear generational divide on this show among the correspondents who thought that rock and roll was here to stay and rock and roll was just a passing fad. Now it is slightly more complicated than that.
So Croft, Safer, and Stahl are joined by Scott Pelley, Bob Simon, and occasional contributors Lara Logan, Katie Couric, Byron Pitts, and CNN's Anderson Cooper. The show was always in part about showbiz, minting stars, and pioneering elements such as the ambush interview, long since discarded by 60 Minutes, and the tight close-up on people as they're speaking. The stars may not burn quite as bright, but 60 Minutes is still riding high. On the day of my second visit, Croft was about to edit a story on
Mark Dreyer, a very prominent New York lawyer who was one of the Mitty Madoffs.
Croft was one of just two reporters to get an interview with Dreyer before he entered federal prison to start a 20-year sentence.
Interview me in a program such as yours would be for something good I've done, not something humiliating I've done.
This isn't the way you wanted to be on 60 Minutes.
No.
Why did you want to do this interview?
To apologize.
You want to use the best material that you've got in the piece. I certainly knew that when I asked President Obama if he was punch drunk, I knew that that was going to get in when he started laughing in the middle of our interview.
Are you punch drunk?
No, there's got to be a little gallows humor to get you through the day.
Former NBC News President Neil Shapiro says interviews, like that one from March, are still propelling the show after all these years, but that a harder edge has given it fresh life.
Jeff has made the show
given a little more zip to it. I think they jump on news stories a little quicker.
Shapiro is now CEO of Public Television's WNET in New York City. But during the 1990s, Shapiro was executive producer of one of 60 Minutes' many imitators, Dateline NBC, which used to run five nights a week. Now, it's down to one.
There are less news magazines around, and they have seemed to settle into a niche which gives 60 Minutes a huge area which is all their own. There was a time when I think at one point there were 20 hours of news magazines on television.
Those that are still on the schedule have veered toward a diet heavy on true crime and celebrity news. At 60 Minutes, Jeff Fager now sits in the very office held for decades by his mentor, the show's creator, the late Don Hewitt, a showman as well as a journalist. And Fager said it took him a bit of time to find sure footing after taking over more than 5 years ago.
I wasn't ready for the fact that so many people wanted to be on this broadcast, especially from the sort of celebrity world. And I think I said yes too much. I know I did. And it was my mistake, and it affected our mix.
Funny thing, back then, ratings were softer. Now Fager promises hard news will remain a bigger part of the mix. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
Coming up in about 4 minutes, it's The World from Public Radio International and the BBC. Iran reveals a second secret nuclear plant, prompting new calls for stronger sanctions. We'll also hear why Canada is the top destination for foreign spies and how earthworms may play a big role in combating climate change. We'll hear those stories and more coming up on The World on AM 580 at 3 o'clock.
These games come at a critical time that we believe can transform our city in a very positive way.
Chicago wants the 2016 Olympics for one big reason.
There is no single event could attract more visitors than that alone. That is a huge impact.
If Chicago hosts the Olympics, hopes and realities for an economic boon. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Earth and Sky.
I think it's really a wonderful demonstration about how science and the law can blend together to do things in a very, very directed way to come up with a very peaceful result.
You're listening to geophysicist Larry Mayer. He's referring to the United Nations Law of the Sea. It's a 27-year-old treaty that allows countries to extend their maritime boundaries if they back their claim requests with science. To support the U.S. claim, Mayer and his team have mapped more than 1 million square kilometers of seafloor since 2003.
Based on the depth of the seafloor, the shape of the seafloor, and the thickness of sediment below,
Mayer said that many countries want to extend their maritime boundaries because of the natural resources contained in and under the sea, like fish, minerals, and petroleum.
There's been lots of misinterpretation about the mapping we're doing.